Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
The month of April has been Autism Awareness Month. Local author Joan Goodrow has written about how her son's autism changed her life. And at 1 o'clock tomorrow, she will be presenting her book, Strangers Together, at the Chico State Bookstore. My guest today is a native Californian. She lived in England and Canada and now lives in Chico. Joan Goodrow has written stories, articles, and poems which have appeared in numerous publications. She recently completed a Hedgebrook writing residency on Whidbey Island, Washington, where she wrote a memoir about her son with autism. The first chapter of this memoir was nominated for the 2012 Pushcart Prize. Her experience as a special education teacher and program specialist allows her to see the puzzle of autism from both the perspective of a parent and a professional. The title of her book is Strangers Together, How My Son's Autism Changed My Life. Joan Goodrow, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you were living in Canada at the time you wrote this story.
Yes, this all took place in Ottawa, Ontario, in Canada.
And you lived in England also?
Yes, I did, but that was before children.
Oh, So you say before children, plural. So when you were living in Canada, Ian, your son with autism, was not your only child?
No, he was surrounded by two older sisters, and then later on a younger brother, but that's another book.
Well, tell me about this, the Hedgebrook Writing Residency on Whidbey Island.
Well, this is a wonderful opportunity for women writers. You apply and you submit your work, and then you wait and see if you're accepted. And I was so excited to go up to Whidbey Island. They have a whole village of little cabins, and I managed to stay at Susan Sarang's cabin. And you just stay out there and you can write, you can take walks, and then at night you come together with about six other authors and share your work and have wonderful, delicious meals prepared by the cook there from their garden.
It sounds like a dream. How long do you get to stay there?
Well, we all didn't want to leave. No one wanted to leave. I got to stay there for 3 weeks. But as I said, people want to stay on longer because it's not just for women writers. Any woman would just love that experience.
Now, had you already started writing your book before you went there, or did you start from once you got to Whidbey Island?
No, I was working on my rough draft and trying to get the stories kind of in order, just trying to sketch it out. And of course, those 3 weeks without any interruptions or distractions, I got a lot of work done.
Oh, that sounds ideal.
Yes.
Well, you find yourself then as you start your story, you're living in Ottawa, you're a single mother, and that alone sounds pretty challenging.
Well, somehow I write quite a few of these stories about winter, and that seemed to affect me and slow me down. Somehow, after the shock of Ian's diagnosis, my brain kind of froze up, and I use winter as an excuse. But actually, I think I was in kind of a daze or shock.
I would think that would be fairly typical of parents, because there's one point in the book where this expert is saying, you know, you're looking forward to this child and you have expectations for this child, hopes and dreams for this child. And that was all okay in age of one, age of two. And then what made you suspect that, I'm not so sure about my son?
Well, I knew that there was something wrong, but I didn't know what it was. And you have to remember that this was 30 years ago. So people weren't as familiar with autism, and they didn't really know at first what was wrong with him. And so
when you say they, you mean experts, doctors,
professionals,
people who That's their job, to know these things.
Exactly.
And even they said, oh, it's probably just
a speech delay. And so we'll send him for speech therapy in a kind of a group. And I still, it didn't make sense to me, because besides the speech delay, he also had trouble relating to others. He seemed kind of locked in his own world. So
you consult experts and you say, I think my son is, I mean, he's not talking. And they say, oh, well, it's just delayed. And you suspect that, no, it's more than that. So why don't you read us a section of your book? This is early in your book. And again, this is 30 years ago that you're talking about.
The speech therapist told us not to worry. Einstein didn't talk until he was 5. Speech would come. It just needed coaxing with some kids. I wonder, did the 3-year-old Einstein reach from his high chair to the pantry and scream while his mother pleaded, "What do you want to eat?" Ian's sisters yell a duet. "What do you want, Ian?" It's a game the whole family can play. I hold up peanut butter, cereal, and canned pineapple one at a time, like a game show hostess trying to make each item look like a prize. Ian shakes his wet red face and reaches his arms even further toward phantom food we cannot see. This guessing game is simple and can be played anywhere. I guess he wants soup when he reaches towards the can and screams when I heat it. The game is over when Ian shoves his dish of untouched alphabet soup onto the floor. I clean the mess with a dirty mop that looks like Ian's hair, stringy with sweat. I stare at the letters tumbled on the linoleum. All these letters make no words or sense. There is no winner in this game.
My guest is Joan Goudreau, and she's reading from her memoir, Strangers Together, How My Son's Autism Changed My Life. And this scene that you described sounds so stressful if it occurred only rarely. Just to have it occur once or twice, something like that would be stressful. But this was fairly typical, it seems like.
Well, this is just the beginning. And, mm-hmm. and afterwards, when he was diagnosed, it was stressful. And I sort of went into shock. And I felt very confused. I felt trapped. I have a story in here, and it talks about being in a maze. And that's kind of what I felt like. It was that I was trapped, and I wanted to escape. And the only way I could escape is kind of through my imagination and my mind. Obviously, I couldn't get a babysitter and just leave. So some of these stories tell about my imaginings and trying to escape.
In fact, I found it very cinematic. I could just see a movie made of your story, and we would have to know what was going on in your mind, because you tell us what you're thinking at these points. And you, for example, say you can't just get a babysitter, like most people get a babysitter for their child. What was your experience trying? Because sometimes you would have to have somebody stay with you.
Well, we ran through quite a few babysitters, and they all needed special training. So I wound up with a babysitter who was young and inexperienced. And in one of the stories, I tell about the hazards of a babysitter who's not really trained. And again, remember, this is 30 years ago, so this is not familiar to people.
Well, you say that you felt you were trapped in a maze. Why don't you look at your book on page 40, Joan, and read us a little bit there, where you describe what it's like. No, you just described this scene, read about this scene where he spills the alphabet soup, and that whole scene is very stressful. You're trying to figure out what he wants, and now you're out in a grocery store.
Well, just a simple, common, ordinary event seemed to be a major incident. With Ian, in the shopping cart in his little basket, his sisters and I head to the shortest line next to the rows of candy bars. Ian stops rocking his head back and forth and snatches one. I grab his hand, pry the chocolate from his fist, and toss it on the counter just out of his reach. His face opens into a pit where a trapped animal howls. Ian shrieks, "Hurry," the cashier, who rings up the groceries, including the candy, and yells, "That'll be $15.45 altogether." My hands shake so much I can hardly open my wallet, and I notice my fingers are covered with chocolate from our skirmish. I shout, "Please throw the candy away. Don't want him to have sugar." Then I shove dollars covered with my chocolate prints over the counter. "Here, you paid for this, hon. Might as well let the baby have it." She hands the glob back to Ian. Either because she cannot hear me over his howls, or she just wants it to stop. The people behind me in line just want the screaming to stop, too. They mutter under their breath, "Look at that spoiled brat." I prefer spoiled brat to autistic. At least brat is in the range of normal. His sister, Monica, looks up and says, "Everybody's looking at us. Let's get out of here."
My guest, Joan Goudreau, reading from her memoir, Strangers Together, How My Son's Autism Changed My Life. And you know, Joan, as I was reading that, thinking, okay, if I were in that shopping line, I would probably think that too. Look at that woman who doesn't know how to discipline her children. Why isn't she teaching them proper manners? I'm just imagining the things that would be going through my mind before I read this. Now that I've read this, I would think twice before I would want to point a finger at a mother.
Well, yes, I have read this section before to other people, and they always blame the cashier, and they always blame the people in line, but they're on the inside, no. You know, I think myself, you know, before I had Ian, I'd just see a child having a tantrum. I wouldn't see possibly a disability involved.
So you can't really take him out shopping very easily. You can't take him
anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Hard to get a babysitter to leave him at home. Hard to take him with you when you go out. So this is why I could see why you'd feel trapped. Mm-hmm. Well, then what kind of help do you seek in the way of professional help for his schooling, for example?
Well, the best thing that happens after his diagnosis is that he goes to Whitehaven Preschool. And this is a wonderful special ed preschool class. He has a wonderful teacher, Paula Broen. And I attend one of the parent meetings. I manage to get some sort of babysitting. And I go to the meeting and I watch a video with the teacher, Paula, and Ian, and I can't recognize my son because he's following directions. He still doesn't talk yet, but he's following directions and he seems to be listening to Paula. And I think, well, who is this boy, you know?
That stranger that I don't know.
That's right.
I live with a different son at home, and here's this stranger who's well behaved and paying attention. And
what's her secret? He looks like a different boy than the Ian we live with at home. We are strangers who live together. We look at each other, but he doesn't see our family. He doesn't play with a sister, just rocks back and forth. He and I come together and push apart like opposite magnetic poles. Silence and screams are his language, and we can't understand. I need help at home to teach me to teach Ian. And so that's when it finally came to me. Well, I'm at that point, I knew it was crucial that I had to get some help for me as well as Ian, help in the home. And so it was a long process, but it was worth it. I went through regional center and through social services, and I got a speech therapist to come into my home and train me, as well as Ian, for speech therapy. I got a respite worker to come in and take Ian out to the community. And I had some wonderful volunteers. One was a high school girl who would just work with Ian with flashcards and signing.
Well, now, how successful were these young people who would come in? And here you are, the mother who'd been trying to also teach him because you had a background professionally. What success did they have, these volunteers that would come into your home?
Well, being a teacher, I thought it would be easy to teach my own son. I soon learned better that even my daughters were much more direct and much better at connecting in a teaching way. I had to be taught how to teach him. And a high school student, Megan, would come in on Saturdays. And she was very successful because one day, Megan, the high school volunteer, practices signing with Ian. Today she holds...
Signing, now you might explain what you mean by that.
Signing is a system of communication that was first used by hard of hearing and deaf people. But now it's being used in a variety of ways. And it seems as though using your fingers to express letters and words somehow imprints the brain. And so we started to use it with Ian. He couldn't speak words, but he could manipulate his fingers because people with autism are visual. So he could manipulate his fingers to sign various words, even some simple phrases.
Well, one thing that I might ask you about, too, is when you're talking about signing, Ian didn't always tell you when he needed to go to the toilet.
Oh, no. It was all a guessing game. But it was a breakthrough when he learned how to sign. It's kind of a closed fist gesture. And sometimes he uses that sign now, and he's 34. So what goes in when you're young stays in.
Well, that would be kind of handy then if you're with a friend, say, or a family member, and
exactly.
You want to signal that you need to go to the bathroom. You can just sign that gesture.
It's very helpful in church. So Megan was practicing signing with him, and she holds a flashcard picture of a cow. And he makes a sign with pointed fingers to show a horn by his forehead. "Good job," says Megan and smiles. Then he says, "Kawa." I dash for my camera and take his picture. Say it again," yells Megan. And I shout and clap. Ian flaps his hands with excitement. We can't believe that he is talking after all this time. I tape his new words as they explode out of his mouth. Cat, dog, bird. He recites all the rest of Noah's Ark. I play the tape back to his sisters when they come back from their friend's home, and we tape some more. "Say dog," Jennifer commands. "Dog," he repeats. We all laugh, and Monica high-fives Ian. Tonight, after the kids are in bed, I'll listen to this tape again, and Ian's voice will fill the silence of the room.
My guest is Joan Goodrow, and she's reading from her memoir, Strangers Together, How My Son's Autism Changed My Life. And so you might remind people how old Ian is at this point, where you're so excited he actually said these words.
He was about 4 years old, and he had finally come out with some words. Once he started saying words, his vocabulary increased. But I have to say that now that he's an adult, he's about 34 years old, and he's basically nonverbal. He can say basic needs that he wants. but he's not going to carry on a conversation or anything like that. But it was a wonderful start, and you asked, did I have success? And I must say that the people who worked with Ian, I've dedicated the book to the friends and the family and all the wonderful volunteers and professionals that worked with him. I also have to add that I had a circle of support with friends and neighbors, but my best friend didn't offer any advice. She just listened. And listened and listened some more, and she accepted our family the way it was.
Well, when you say she didn't offer advice, because it would be tempting, I think, for people to offer advice. I mean, even
I got a lot of advice.
Even from your own daughters.
Oh, yes.
And yet, the expert, you quote it toward the end of your book, admits that even the experts don't have all the answers.
No, I think they're trying to learn as fast as the parents are. And I just received an email from a psychologist, a school psychologist that I used to work with in Southern California. And he said, I never realized what living with a child with autism was like. And here's a man who studied autism. He works with students with autism and their parents, and he never really realized the day-to-day concerns. And I was very pleased to hear this, because one of the reasons that I wrote this book was to help professionals get some insight into what the parents' lives were like. And I have read some of these stories, especially Homework is a chapter that tells about parents and teachers and their relationships. I've read this at education classes at Chico State, and I have really enjoyed getting feedback and reaction back from reading these stories there.
Because most of us can't imagine why you might be late for a meeting. Ian's all dressed, and then all of a sudden his clothes are wet because he didn't tell you he needed to go to the toilet. So everything that seems like it would be simple is not. And you just talk about the quantity of laundry that you have to do.
Yes.
Or the time that you're going to go out to this farm, and you'd think you were going away for a long trip, because just a short time, there's so much to think about, all the clothes that you have to take. And how was that visit to the farm?
The visit to the farm was very freeing for Ian and for me as a mother.
Because typically, autistic and your son didn't like new situations. They want familiar situations. So here you're wondering, oh my gosh, here he's going out to this farm. And how did it turn out?
Well, it turned out fine. And I always kind of, by this time, expected the worst. I was always trying to prepare. I was always telling people, oh, this is going to happen and that's going to happen. I think after a while, parents with autistic children, they tend to fear change as much as their children. And when I saw him just kind of going with the flow and enjoying the relaxed family that he was with, then I was relieved. But also, it taught me, you know, life goes on, and Ian is going to grow, and he's going to change, and it's going to be all right.
Yeah, I really liked the farm couple. The woman was so understanding. Oh. She seemed to have a heart of gold.
She did, and she didn't have an overview of worry and concern and anxiety. And I said, oh, no, he has to have his special plate, Matt, and he has to have his special plate. And she just very casually, you know, guided him through. And I left him with Jim watching football. And, of course, I was afraid of the dog. He would be afraid. No, Ian just kind of curled up and settled right in with the family.
So all these worries that you had before taking him there proved to be unnecessary, because he adapted and he did fine there.
And it opened up my mind, too, to the fact that Change can be really good, and unexpected blessings come in all sorts of ways.
Well, your book is about this first year from the time he was diagnosed, this first year that of how you managed to cope with it. And you say that parents feel alone when they're facing these day-to-day problems. And you have kind of a summary toward the end of your book of the progress that Ian made. And you describe this on page 97, Joan.
Changes in routine still upset Ian, but he has made many changes this year. He names the colors of his big crayons and asks for what he wants with three or four words. He says or signs please and thank you, if you remind him, just like any other four-year-old. And he hugs friends back now, another big change. It's been a long year since Ian was diagnosed. The neurologist who first told us that Ian had autism said, "The brain is like outer space, and we're just starting to explore it. We're explorers, not experts. The closest thing to experts are parents, because you know your kids better than anyone else." I don't feel like an expert, but at least Ian isn't the stranger he was a year ago. This past year, I've gotten to know him, thanks to help from others.
My guest is Joan Goodrow, and her book is Strangers Together: How My Son's Autism Changed My Life. And you're saying that you were told you were the expert because you're the parent.
That's kind of scary.
And that seems to be that these children are unique in their experiences and what works for them. There was a recent article in the New York Times Magazine by Ron Suskin, and he said their autistic son seems unreachable until they discovered the language of Disney. He liked to watch Disney videos, and they discovered that this was a way of reaching him, that he would sing along with these Disney songs, and they were, this was an approach, who would have ever guessed that? It was unique to this child.
It is so mysterious, and the sort of trademark icon is a ribbon with puzzle pieces, not just one color, but puzzle pieces, and it really is a puzzle that's hard to put the pieces together. My son would sit in the preschool, the co-op preschool that he went to in the afternoon, and the kids would be singing songs, and he wouldn't look at them, and he wouldn't sing with them, and he looked like he was just in his own little world. And then about midnight, he would wake up, and of course wake me up, singing "The Wheels on the Bus" and all the other songs that the other kids were singing. So music is a way, but it's always a mystery.
So you have to study your own child and see what might be a way to get through to this child.
There's no guidebooks.
Well, you've said that, Ian, this is 30 years ago. We don't seem to have learned a whole lot about it in those 30 years as far as to how to address these problems. But your son is living on his own now?
He's living in a support home through California Vocations in Paradise, and he's also in a day program. And I must say that there is more support and services for parents now, and I urge them to go to Regional Center and seek out all the help that's available to them.
Thank you. My guest has been Joan Goodrow. Her book, Strangers Together: How My Son's Autism Changed My Life. After a short break, I'm going to ask Joan about an international autism conference that she attended. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Welcome back to Nancy's Bookshelf. I'm Nancy Wigman, and I'm continuing my conversation with writer and poet Joan Goodrow, author of a memoir, Strangers Together, How My Son's Autism Changed My Life, and a collection of poems, Another Secret Shared, which explores her family's life on the autism spectrum and her experiences as a cancer survivor. Joan, welcome back. And I mentioned that you attended an international conference on autism. Tell us about that.
Well, it was a conference in Honolulu, and I got the opportunity to meet many educators and teachers and also students. It was sponsored by the Exceptional Children's Council, and it was the International Conference on Autism, Intellectual Disability, and Developmental Disabilities.
Now, you said there were students at the conference, and
yes.
You mean these are students?
College students.
College students who are on the...
Who are preparing... learning strategies on how to teach and also how to communicate with parents. And that's what Dr. Todd and I talked about, was the gap between the communication gap between parents and their students and parents and teachers.
So
we addressed this, gave some strategies on how to get around this gap, because it is very difficult for teachers and parents to kind of get on the same page.
So when you attended, it was more than just a person there to learn. You were there to help teach others. You were an invited speaker.
Yes. I spoke with Dr. Terry Todd from the California State University at Northridge.
So you and he together were, kind of a panel.
Yes.
To help these people who are students. What kind of, are they're college students, you say, you can't choose a major in autism. What are their majors?
Well, these were basically students who were professionals, but getting their PhD on the side.
And so these were grad students you're talking
right,
to.
Right, graduate students kind of going beyond. And also there were teachers who taught on the college level, who taught in special education classes, too. So we got a good variety, a good span.
Of people who want to help parents and the children.
And the children in the special ed classes.
Who are on the autism spectrum.
Right. And one of the things I learned about was a whole group of books. And these are... characters with developmental disabilities, and they're all up for the Dolly Gray Children's Literature Award. This is given every year to books with characters who have autism, Asperger's, and other disabilities. And there's a whole list of books here that you can buy on the internet. Or a lot of teachers there at the conference were going to use them as teaching tools. They were going to use them in the classroom.
So what's an example of one of the titles of these books?
Lucy's Amazing Friend. That's what it's called. A Story of Autism and Friendship. And it's by Stephanie Workman. Of course, these books are for all ages, so this one is a picture book, and the illustrator is Tim Raines. Another example is Silent Voice by Barry Rudner, and Thomas Loves, a rhyming book about fun, friendship, and autism.
Now, there's a combination. Fun. You don't usually think about that, because raising an autistic child... there is fun, but that's not the first word that comes to mind.
And that's why these books are special. And I was glad to know that they're up for awards, and that each year these books are looked at and with an eye for this and given awards. The author of that book was Jude Welton, and the illustrator was Jane Tedford. And the list is quite long. There's also books.
You've got 2 pages there, small
yes.
print.
Yes.
2 pages of books, of these kinds of books.
And Asperger's, Down syndrome, it really addresses a lot of different disabilities. So that was my big takeaway, was there are books out there for use in the family or in the classroom. And again, that helps kind of close the gap between communication, if you have books like this that can draw you together.
My guest is Joan Goodrow, and she is the mother of an autistic son, and she is a writer, a poet, and you can also call yourself an autism educator.
I was a special ed teacher, and I was also a program specialist at the district level, so I got a chance to see autism from both ways, from being a parent of a son with autism and also from the professional side.
So you weren't one of these professionals, because there are those who don't have direct experience with autism, and some of them expressed surprise at what life was really like on a daily basis, which you describe in your book, what it was like on a day-to-day basis to be raising an autistic child, and you helped them to understand what it was like.
The psychologist talked to me, and he said he had worked with parents and children with autism his whole career, but he never knew what the day-to-day was like until he read my books. So that made me feel as though my message was getting through.
And that you had provided a service to yeah. so many people, not just parents of autistic children, but also professionals who work with families.
And I've also heard from people who don't have direct experience with kids with autism that this just kind of opens up for them. It really opens a window of understanding for them.
And with understanding comes patience?
We hope so. And the other person that I met, I had to go to Honolulu to meet her. She's actually a professor from Chico State here, Dr. Tella Kepper. She is researching and developing a reading system for nonverbal and low verbal readers. So this is really hard to understand how, if a student is nonverbal, how can you check if he's understanding the book?
And so you had to go all the way to Hawaii to meet somebody from Chico who was
exactly.
interested in the same subject, in autism.
Exactly. And she's adapting books and using visual clues so that the children can tell you if they can comprehend or not.
Because that's pretty much the case with your son, is it not?
Yes. He's nonverbal. He can use some signs, and if he wants a hamburger, he'll tell you, but he doesn't usually, it's hard to elicit speech from him.
So you would be an expert in what Dr. Kemper is investigating. And I believe you said she has developed a reading system that can include these nonverbal students.
Yes, she's doing research on it and testing and developing this system.
And were you able to give some input to help her with her project?
Actually, what I want to do is find out more about her system, because I'd like to try it out with Ian. I think that would be very interesting.
And so what else did you do at the conference?
Well, we presented, and we went into various workshops, and we found out about these books, and I met a lot of professionals.
When you were there at the conference.
Right.
My guest is Joan Goodrow, and she is author of 2 books, Strangers Together, How My Son's Autism Changed My Life. And then she has a collection of poems, Another Secret Shared and Other Poems. And you have other family members who also were affected by autism who contribute to your book. You write about in your book of poems how it affected them.
Yes, I wrote about how it affected them, And I checked with them to make sure that it was reflecting their real feelings. You can't just sit down and say, oh, what do you think about Ian? You have to kind of listen to them when they're talking about their dreams and kind of observing. It can't be a direct kind of interview. Over the years, I got a good glimpse of how they felt about Ian, and I put them in these poems.
Well, when Ian was very small, you must have, and you were not here in the United States, you were in Canada at that time, you must have felt rather isolated as far as the general population even knowing what autism was.
Well, Ian is in his 30s now, so you can imagine back then, people didn't have family members. People didn't know friends who had children with autism. So it was a very different world, and it was hard to find services and support.
Well, I recently saw an article, I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal, a PhD was writing in saying that progress in treating autism, there is progress, but no magic bullet so far. And he was responding to an article, and this person writing says, the first time I evaluated an autistic child in the 1970s, I met two warm, loving, guilt-ridden parents telling me through their tears about their unresponsive, odd 5-year-old child who didn't talk and was obsessed with playing with doorknobs and hinges. When this child entered my office, he walked past me as if I wasn't there and went straight to the curtains and began sucking on the cloth. And here he describes the parents. He said they were warm, loving, guilt-ridden parents telling me through their tears about their child. And when you were going through this, you, and this person is writing in the 70s, you couldn't, probably there weren't other parents you could ask, how do you cope with this? Or is it my fault? Is it something I did? You didn't have these resources, which now are more available. So did you have any thoughts like that? Is it something I could have done differently?
Oh, you think about it all the time. You think, oh, I took an aspirin when I was pregnant. Oh, I wonder if that caused it. And you go through the stages of grief. Some people get stuck in denial. And so if you ask them, oh, you know, it's so hard at home. Is it hard with you? They'll say, oh, No, that's no problem. Or if they send their child to school, oh, well, my son can't talk yet, but he's going to college. And that's just another phase of the process of going through grief. Because basically, you had this sort of dream child in your mind. And when this dream child didn't turn out to be the way you thought, the hard part is kind of living with the child with autism, accepting him the way he is, and letting go of whatever dream that we had. And so we kind of go through grief processes that way.
Well, another difference, too, this PhD was writing in to say that he had two parents coming in to see him, and you were on your own.
Yes, I was a single parent, and I often say my target audience can't come to listen to me read because they're too busy at home, they can't get a babysitter, they have too much laundry, their car doesn't work, they don't have enough money for the gas. So my target audience is kind of absent, and when I read, I always have an empty chair in honor of the mother who can't make it.
Who would have liked to have been there.
But can't make it.
The very people who most need to hear what you have to say, would most like to come to a support group, is not able to.
Exactly. Yes, yes.
My guest is Joan Goodrow, and she is the mother of an autistic child. She helps educate others in autism. And you mentioned that some people are in denial, their parents, and say, oh, no, everything's fine. And so it's little wonder that a professional, if he doesn't or she does not have an autistic child himself, doesn't really know how bad it can be, how difficult, how challenging it can be if the person comes in and tries to minimize, oh, it's okay, and yeah, my son's not talking now, but he'll be talking soon.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And again, you have this gap between teachers and between parents in school. Because one of the things we found in our presentation when we were doing research is that communication is not taught, even in your advanced classes in most universities, how to communicate with a grief-stricken parent. It's not even discussed. So these are the kinds of things that need to be studied more, and the strategies on how you actually talk to parents and how you get them involved in the education system.
Well, let's take a look at that then. How can parents, what are the resources? For example, here in Chico, we mentioned this conference that you went to in Hawaii. Anything
yes.
else you learned or taught there?
I found it very interesting that they suggest using plays as a way of eliciting a verbal response from children. And right here in Chico, we have a lot going on in terms of plays and theater. Now, on Broadway, there's the famous play about autism and Asperger's, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Hayden.
That was a popular book, yes.
Popular book turned into an award-winning play. And also, there's an off-Broadway play called Falling by Deanna Jant. And some of these theaters have provided modifications on certain days for an audience with people with autism. And what they've done is they've kind of shrunk the lobby, not so big, not so open. They've reduced the noise level and limited the audience so there's not as many people. And
you might mention that the reason they've done this is because this bothers some
yes. people. Sensitivity to mm-hmm. noise and light. So they've reduced the noise, lowered the lights, dimmed the lights, and they've gotten a lot of really good feedback from them. But in terms of what's going on right here in Chico, it's very exciting because the Little Red Hen sponsors the Not Your Garden Variety Theater program during the summer.
And that's the Little Red Hen is here in Chico.
Is here in Chico with several stores and also with the autism spectrum. And this is a summer program. Last summer, 22 children from the ages of 4 to 18, and I find that remarkable, that they can get those different ages. They performed The Wizard of Oz, and not only did they play it, but it incorporated other skills.
And that's a huge cast.
Oh, it's
22.
Huge.
22 in that cast.
And the age span and how they did that. They used arts and crafts. They taught arts and crafts, and they got the props and the costumes. Now, the Little Red Hen converted a warehouse for these programs, and they built a beautiful stage with a backdrop, and they have a puppet stage. And they use it year-round because in the after-school programs, they have kids, again, from 4 to through teens, and they come in and they use the stage and the puppet play. And I asked Brooke Burrows, who's the director of The Wizard of Oz and works with the kids in the after school program. And I couldn't understand. I said, well, didn't you have tryouts? She said, no.
No
tryouts.
Auditions.
No auditions, no pressure. And they have to be clients of Regional Center. That's what they have to be. But it's open to all ages. And I said, well, what about nonverbal? She said, oh, that's easy. We just use an iPad. And they press the button. Isn't that creative?
Yes, it is.
And then limited verbal. They have play buddies, actor buddies. And what they do is they just say the sentence and then the other person just copies it and mimics it, and then gradually they fade out the buddy. And
This is during rehearsals.
This is during rehearsals. Mm-hmm. And they use peer actors to help them not feel alone on stage. They're feeling like, oh, I'm all there by myself. And they're going to continue to use The Wizard of Oz.
Now, you brought a copy of this publication called Autism Lifespan, and it serves a huge number of counties here in the North State, Butte, Glenn, Tehama, Shasta, Trinity, Siskiyou, Lassen, Modoc, and Plumas counties, this publication of Autism Lifespan. And you have some beautiful color pictures on the front page of this publication with The Wizard of Oz.
Right, right. And Brooks said that they're going to keep The Wizard of Oz because it's about people coming together to make friends and have an adventure with a common goal.
Well, in fact, if you were to look at these photographs, and if you didn't know this was a publication about autism, you would never know that.
No.
These look like any group of actors, any group of children in a play here in Chico.
Exactly. Now, these performances are open to the family and friends, but so far they haven't really opened it to public because they want people who can understand the actors, and sometimes, you know, they have meltdowns or run off the stage or something like that. But they're thinking about a DVD, which I think is just a wonderful idea. And then an agency that works with adults with autism and developmental disabilities is Mainsail, and Mainsail sponsors the Theater of the Now at the 7th Street Center of the Arts.
And where is this?
It's at 7th, on 7th Street, at 7th Street Center of the Arts. It's sponsored
in Chico.
In Chico. It's sponsored by Mainsail. And one of their mottos is a quote from Viola Spolin, "To act is to be present." And that's why their theater is called the Theater of the Now. And I thought it was so interesting. Natalie Valencia is the director, and she said that they don't just learn acting. They learn dance. They learn music. They're learning video, how to do video. They do poetry. Sometimes they write their own scripts. Sometimes not, and they go into the elementary schools. They also have productions right there on 7th Street. They have a warehouse there. And if you'd like more information or maybe an invitation to the next performance, you can go on Facebook and go to Facebook Theater of the Now. And click like, and you can get more information, get on their Facebook. Now, the interesting thing is it's not just for acting. They work on their behavior goals and their social goals as well. So it really encourages them to use self-control and to be part of a team.
My guest is Joan Goodrow, and she is the mother of an autistic son, and she is a writer. She wrote a memoir, Strangers Together, How My Son's Autism Changed My Life, and a collection of poems, Another Secret Shared. And you're mentioning local organizations that provide support for autism spectrum disorder. What about Monca? There's a new museum, fairly new here in Chico. Is Monca doing anything to serve the autistic community?
Well, the last pop-up exhibit that they had was wonderful because it not only highlighted artists with disabilities, it actually gave a special room for the exhibition. And the room was set aside in the little storefront. They had built it.
You might explain
especially.
What a pop-up is.
A pop-up museum is where they take a little storefront, and they will use it for a very brief time, maybe 3 or 4 weeks. And they put the art up and tell everyone about it. And these pop-ups have been very popular.
Well, so. I mentioned it, MONCA stands for the Museum of Northern California Art, and they're working on renovating the building, a permanent building for MONCA. But meanwhile, they have these exhibits, as you just mentioned, a storefront that makes itself available to them. And for an organization like people with spectrum disorder,
and
autistic spectrum.
Right.
So.
The alcove that they built was taken from a design by Kijong Jean. I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly. I got to meet him at the exhibition, and it was very exciting. He's an associate professor, again, here at Chico. And what he did, he designed a special room for Cove for a day program. And he made sure, again, that there were various lights and textures that were conducive to encouraging sensory and stimulation. Also, at the same time, he wanted it to have a calming effect, and so that the adults coming in there on their day program would have a place to feel safe and to relax. So they tried to reproduce this on a smaller scale. They put in beanbag chairs, and I think you can see in one of the pictures there.
Yes, Joan brought photographs of some of the artwork that was on the walls of this pop-up museum.
Yes.
And I might mention that they're actually beautiful and quite colorful. Here's one of flowers, a horse. They're beautiful paintings. These were done by adults, you say, on the autistic spectrum disorder.
And they take a class at Butte College.
So these paintings were produced in this class at Butte College.
Right. And it shows a room, and it's the alcove, and it's a very simple layout. It doesn't have a bunch of paintings. It just has one painting on the wall. It has kind of lighted bubbles, and it has a bean bag chair.
Well, it's so exciting to hear all that is going on here to help people with parents, students, professionals who work with people on the autism spectrum disorder. Thank you so much, Joan, for all the work that you do. My guest is Joan Goodreau. She is author of Strangers Together, How My Son's Autism Changed My Life, and Another Secret Shared. Thank you, Joan.
Thank you.
Tomorrow at 1 p.m., Joan Goodreau will be presenting her book, Strangers Together, at the Chico State Bookstore in recognition of Autism Awareness Month. You can hear this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.